Welcome to Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk. I'll bring you all kinds of stories from all kinds of people. Whether it's a live public conversation and we're speaking from the kitchen table of my 1965 Beeline travel trailer, from the studios or on the streets, please sit back and enjoy the conversation right here this time every week. Welcome. With Trailer Talk's Frack Talk Marcellus Shale Water Project, we're exploring the impact of natural gas drilling and fracking on our water resources and the issues being debated in our neighborhoods throughout the United States and globally. We're facing a complete shift in the shale regions as the largest ever concentration of gas lies beneath our feet. Who are we and what decisions will we make?
Ooh, on a cold day, and I have Bill Streeter in the trailer with me, as well as a friend of his. Who do you have with you?
This is Mortimer. He's a sawhet owl. Sawhets are the third smallest owl in North America and the smallest owl in the Northeast. He weighs 3 ounces, has an 18-inch wingspan, and a very, very big head for his size.
He is a gorgeous, gorgeous bird. Mortimer, hello. How much does Mortimer weigh?
Mortimer weighs 3 ounces.
And he does look much larger than 3 ounces.
He certainly looks larger than 3 ounces, but still, it looks like he stands about 5 or 6 inches high. Very tiny, probably one of the sweetest faces of any owl that you're ever going to see.
A very sweet face. So tell me why you had to rehabilitate Mortimer. You are a raptor rehabilitator, which means that you take birds that have been injured and attempt to rehabilitate them so they can go back into the wild, but that's not always possible.
That's correct. Mortimer was hit by a car in New York State. He was found by a man who was coming home from work at 4:30 in the morning, and he found him roadside in the snow, scooped him up, made some phone calls, eventually took him to a museum called the Museum of the Hudson Highlands in Cornwall, New York, because he remembered that they had live screech owls on exhibit at the museum. He brought the Mortimer to the museum, and the museum staff called us because they're a museum, they're not rehabilitators. We came to assess Mortimer. Mortimer was in shock, so we had to treat him for shock to stabilize him, and discovered that he was blind in his left eye, and then it was a waiting game to see if indeed sometimes vision returns over time. So far it has not, so it probably won't for him. Most of our birds do go back into the wild, so Mortimer is used for education, and sawhets are like perfect education birds.
Because of their size?
First of all, they're very gentle, they're very easy to train, and their look is just spectacular. Anybody who looks into the eyes of a sawhet owl, I mean, it's hard not to be impressed by a little creature that looks like this.
For this last road session of 2009, we've pieced together various conversations celebrating and advocating for the preservation of our wilderness and the importance of the beauty of the natural landscape.
I'm looking at his eyes, which are dark brown in the center, and then there's a
bright
mm-hmm. yellow rim, and he's beautiful brown and cream colored. Yep. How did you and your wife, you are the Delaware Valley Raptor Center and education and rehabilitation, yourself, Bill, and your wife, Stephanie Streeter.
Again.
How did it all begin? You're dealing with birds
right.
that are wild. They're right. often very dangerous and difficult to deal with, especially if
sure.
they're injured. And you have to have such knowledge
right.
to be able to help them.
Well, I've always had a love of animals ever since I was a child. I was one of these kids that just explored everything, you know, grabbed salamanders and crayfish and newts and all that. And eventually went to school and majored in biology and got an advanced degree in zoology. My wife Stephanie, on the other hand, was a music major, but she was always the ultimate caregiver as a child. She would take care of injured wildlife before there were any rules and regulations when she was a little kid. And 26 years ago, when we were living in Massachusetts, we saw a man do a birds of prey program in a nature center. I had read articles about falconry the night before, just by circumstance, kismet, whatever you want to call it. And I asked him questions about falconry. He asked if I wanted to become a falconer, and I said, no, I don't have the time. And Stephanie said, yes, she would. And she became the second licensed woman falconer in Massachusetts history. This was back in 1979. So she became an apprentice falconer flying a red-tailed hawk, and then I got into it and became a falconer. And then people started bringing us injured hawks, you know, because they knew we had them.
Where were you living at the
time?
We
were living in a little town called South Athol, Massachusetts. And we had a center called this was right before we developed what was called the North Quabbin Raptor Rehabilitation Center at that time. So we ended up learning wildlife medicine from a local veterinarian, plus Tufts University Veterinary School Wildlife Clinic trained us extensively, and we had a working relationship with them. Eventually, we moved back to Pennsylvania, which is our home state, and we incorporated the Delaware Valley Raptor Center in 1987.
And so it's an educational center so that people learn more about these birds, understand them. What is the...
Education is a very, very big part of what we do. We do outreach education programs. We go into schools, and any special interest groups that wants a program, nature centers. We do anywhere from 150 to 175 live birds of prey education programs a year, which brings in about half of our operating budget. There's no federal or state money for what we do, so we have to raise it privately. And education is a big part of what we do. It's a big part of our mission. We can put maybe 50, 60 raptors back into the wild this year, and that'll certainly have an impact for the individual birds that go back. It's not going to have much of an impact on wildlife populations, but we'll educate maybe 20,000 people, 20,000 kids this year. That has the potential to be a big impact of how people treat, respect, and learn about wildlife.
Where would I see in the wild here in Sullivan County or over across the Delaware and Pennsylvania, where would I see an owl like Mortimer, or where would I see the kinds of birds that you're showing us here
today? Saw-whets are a little bit less common. They're difficult to see because of, first of all, they're tiny. They're very nocturnal. You're less likely to see them at dawn or at dusk. You're going to see them well after dark. They're not birds of open country, so they're less likely to be seen flying across the road where the fields are. So we don't get many. We get saw-whets once every couple of years, although they are out there. They like cedar swamps, deciduous woods, some wetter areas as well. What we get plenty of are great horned owls, barred owls, and screech owls. And those are the three owls that you are very likely to see in the area. They're certainly a little bit more visible by their behavior, and certainly the barred owls and the great horned owls by their size.
Are they at all threatened by development, population of...
All wildlife is. Habitat destruction is the major reason why wildlife can eventually go extinct. No place to live, wildlife disappears. So there's going to be an impact whenever. But, you know, it seems to be the way of the world.
Yes, it does. What about an owl like Mortimer and the small falcon that I saw?
The American kestrel.
Eat mice.
Yes.
What about the larger birds? Is there an issue, too, of any kind of shortage of their food supply?
Actually, there's always going to be plenty of mice. I was talking to a man the other day where we had to pick up an injured red-tailed hawk, and he said, you know, there's no rabbits around anymore because of all these red-tails. And that actually is not the case. First of all, red-tails will eat rabbits, but they're mostly mouse hunters. Secondly, it's the availability of prey that determines the amount of predators in the area. So if you're seeing a lot of red-tails, that means there's an awful lot of food out there that red-tails eat. So if they were subsisting only on rabbits, and if the rabbits were gone, of course the red-tails wouldn't be there.
And what about with the large owls? What else would they eat? Rabbits, mice?
Rabbits, squirrels.
Will they eat
other
cats?
Raptors, smaller raptors. A cat would be an extremely dangerous prey.
Oh, okay.
So they learn in a hurry what's easy, what's safe, what's smart. And a cat is not a smart animal to go after. It'd be you're most likely to get injured going after a cat. A kitten at night would be easy prey for a great horned owl. And I'm sure
yes.
A great horned owl has killed adult cats on occasion as well, because pound for pound, a great horned owl is a very big and powerful bird. But most predators learn to eat specific prey, and if they see something that is uncommon, they tend to avoid it. They certainly tend to hesitate before they strike at something, because they're not quite sure what this is.
What's amazing to me about an owl in the wild, I've only had the opportunity several times at my home. For a couple of years, I would spot an owl as I was pulling up at night, and just as my headlights were going off, I would see an owl in the evergreen trees, a beautiful, beautiful owl. There's something so beautiful about their stillness. there's a quiet.
Whenever you see an owl, I say it's a day maker. You know, it's something that has just made your day very, very special, because they're not easy to see. And yeah, there is a serenity. Not that they're serene birds, but when you see one, it's a very special feeling. First of all, it's at night, and things are usually very calm to begin with. And so there's a little bit of an excitement, but it's always mixed with a little bit of serenity as well.
You would be able to answer this for me when this is happening. It's only several times during the season, and I'll hear screeching at night. It sounds like a bird hunting, but I don't know.
If you're hearing screeching, what you're not hearing is a screech owl, okay? Because screech mm-hmm. owls don't screech. They have this very down-the-scale trill, kind of a thing like that. But it's a little bit, actually I can't do it. It's a uh-huh. down the scale whinny almost. What you probably are hearing are barred owls. Barred owls have a basic call that they do. It's supposed to sound like who cooks for you, who cooks for you all. But they also have all kinds of screeches and yells and shrieks, and it sounds like there's a disaster happening
yes,
in the woods.
Yes, it's always in the middle
yeah.
of the night.
Yeah.
And it's usually, I feel like it's springtime.
Yeah.
That it's happening.
That's when they're the noisiest.
Okay.
Because the mating season is beginning. So they're defending territories against other owls, and they're calling to, males are calling to females are calling back again.
Which birds would you say are you most amazed by?
I'm certainly most impressed by a golden eagle. My golden eagle died a few months ago. I had her for 20 years.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I
20 years?
20, yeah. I've never, ever... probably experienced a relationship with a bird quite as intense as that. They're big, they're beautiful, they're impressive, they're intelligent. And so if anybody ever asks me what my favorite bird is, certainly all the eagles are special. Bald eagles are special, and I've seen some exotic eagles as well that I've been close to. But certainly my closest relationship has been with that golden of 20 years.
Could you describe that relationship? What did you share with each other? And that is a huge loss after
we did
20 years.
It was a huge loss, and I'm still grieving for her. The good news is perhaps in a couple of weeks I'm getting another one that's been placed at our center from another wildlife rehabilitation center in Wyoming. So, and this bird needs a home, and we're the perfect home, and it's just what I'm going to really need to heal from the death of Crystal. She was 25 years old, actually. I had her for 21 years, my 21-year relationship with her. What can you say? I guess if you were lucky enough to have, and eagles certainly aren't pets, but if, you know, most people can't relate to eagles, you don't have that experience that I've had, but say if you had a favorite pet that you've bonded with, and you've shared experiences with and extend that out to 20 years, it's basically like having a member of the family. So when I go out to feed my birds every morning and look into her flight enclosure and she's not there, it's just very difficult.
These are wild birds, but you do develop a very intimate relationship. Mortimer's here
yes.
with you and comfortable, and I saw you with the birds.
And they adjust to captivity over time. You know, birds of prey aren't affectionate by nature. It's not like having a dog or anything like that. But eagles are a little bit more special to me. They're a little bit different. And I could genuinely say that there was a sincere bond between me and that particular bird. And some of the others. The red tail that I use for program chirps at me every morning when I come out to feed her. And, you know, if I hand feed her something, she'll just reach down and grab it out of, you know, from her beak. And she'll keep chirping at me until I go away. So
well,
it's pretty lucky in many ways.
Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Bill Streeter, let me grab one picture before
okay.
you go.
Can they hear us outside?
Yes.
And make an announcement for the... Yeah, there's going to be a Birds of Prey program very, very shortly. It's scheduled for 1 o'clock. I'm at Trailer Talk right now, and I'm going to be going over there within the minute. So if you're interested in coming to the Birds of Prey program, please come to the end tent, and we will be starting the program within a few minutes.
Thank you very much.
The brushy-tailed ringtail possum has the heartbreaking distinction of being the first mammal species to become extinct because of global warming, climate change, erratic weather patterns, the increase of the Earth's temperature, its high fever. Is our hunger for fossil fuels, for having more, our binge on the planet insatiable? I'm thinking about our relationship to the planet, our willingness to make sacrifices, to advocate for it, which really is us, our place within the universe, As we multiply and organize, as we war and as we create, as the glaciers melt while the polar bears die, and as our mistakes and loving accumulate, can we increase our commitment to a worldwide environmental movement?
Darren McCosco. I cut logs for a living. I just think 50 years ago, 60 years ago, it was a lot different than it is now. And I think global warming is happening just because it don't snow as much as it used to. And just, you can tell the weather's a lot different. It just ain't how it's supposed to be. I'm 23, my dad's 63, and he just tells me how the winters used to be and how we used to get so much snow, and now we don't get no snow, and the summers aren't even hot no more. They're just more humid. It's just moisture in the air from, I guess, the glaciers melting. I'd hate to see the world change like that. I mean, if the climate's changing, the trees are going to grow different, and just everything's going to start changing.
Hi, my name is Joan. I think that it is many problems sort of wrapped up in one, and I think it stems from overpopulation. And I think if the human race got their overpopulation under control, a lot of the other things would be able to get under control as well.
The quality of our lives here on this planet are directly connected to the quality of the environment. And that's something that we need to maintain and to do the best we can to enhance it. And there are so many obvious examples of that. One of the most clearly one globally is the increase of the temperature around the planet and the likelihood of continued global warming. Mm-hmm. It isn't absolutely definite, but all of the evidence so far indicates that this planet is warming up. A good part of that has to do with the emissions that come up from carbon and the production of fossil fuels and the burning of all of those materials, coal and a whole host of things. These are things that we have to deal with. And we have to also deal with things that have been dealt with here in this region for a long, long time, like protecting the open environment, protecting the natural system, protecting the woods, the trees, the natural resources here in the Catskill Mountains. Catskill Mountains are a great example of the kinds of things that are so wonderful and beautiful. As I travel across the district that I represent, I travel across the Catskill Mountains frequently. It's just a marvelous experience. It's a beautiful, beautiful place, and it's something that we need to protect and enhance, make stronger and more beneficial as time goes on. It's a matter of responsibility to continue to protect this land and to enhance it, make it stronger, make it more effective, make it more livable, and make the contents of it more safe and secure for our generation and for an indefinite number of future generations.
Thank you so much, Congressman Maurice Cinci.
Thank you.
I'm Carolyn. I worry about it all the time. I really do. One thing that I think about when you use the term climate change is that I hate that term. It's so neutral. I think there's, without a doubt, the fact that what we're experiencing now is man-made. And change sounds like it could be simply and only a natural process. And I don't think that's true. I don't think anyone thinks that anymore or can sustain that belief for very long. So I'm trying to think of an alternative term, climate catastrophe, catastrophic climate change, climate crisis, weather meltdown. All of those things seem better. Global warming, too, I think it sounds pleasant. And I don't think the results are going to be very pleasant, or even now they are not.
My name is Midge Maroney. I live in Chandelier and in Manhattan.
Climate change?
Climate change. There's no such thing. Yeah, right. I think this summer and last winter is an absolute indication. I mean, you can look at weather patterns and you see that the Canadian cold air that we never had before that has just stayed there this summer. I'm not a scientist. I teach English. But it's obvious the pattern is there. It's too much change worldwide. It's definitely global change, climate change, weather change. The polar bear is sitting on an ice cube as we speak. So
the land with its majesty, its open wild spaces, and its mysterious and necessary diversity is more valuable than piles of gold. These mountains and the river valleys with their beauty nourishes us so generously is at present being compromised by the trading of land for leases in this Marcellus Shale region. This is the place that I call home, and where I listen to the singing of the trees and the songs of the water, where I hear the magical pulse of life and of the possibility of future. What happens if the energy companies buy it and we become swallowed by the deadly chemicals, by radioactive materials, and the polluted water that provides life for everything?
Who will want to live near this kind of an industry? I mean, you wouldn't want to be anywhere near one of these things. The traffic, the tanks, the dust, the noise, the lights. I'm Maria Grimaldi, and I live outside of Youngsville, New York. I guess I'm an avid environmentalist. I have a small organic farm. I am a member of the Catskill Mountain Keeper Association. I'm a former Cornell Cooperative Extension educator. I was on the board of directors of the Sullivan County Soil and Water Conservation District, and I'm very concerned about these issues that are coming before us. Very concerned.
And Maria, what are your concerns?
So many people have worked so hard to take care of our beautiful environment up here, our water resources, our farmland, the trees, the animals, the peace and the quiet, and to allow an industry that is so polluting as this hydrofracking operation of going for natural gas to come into the Catskill Park, the National Park area along the Delaware River and in the Catskill Forest, is to me totally outrageous. I just don't understand, what are they thinking? It's just outrageous to allow an industry to come in to help make money for a handful of people and put all of our natural resources in jeopardy. This is not something that's going to invite tourists and second homeowners to come here and invest in good properties. Who is going to benefit from this operation? A handful of landowners who, for whatever reasons, whether they are financially strapped or whether they're just greedy, or these big companies such as Halliburton. Do we need to go there again? I mean, who are the real terrorists here coming into an area that is so peaceful and so beautiful? And all right, maybe a little impoverished right now, but you know, there's nothing wrong with a little poverty once in a while. It humbles us.
Yeah, I'm Laura Moran. None of this can be, I mean, plants and people need some very basic things in order to live and survive. And a couple of the things that we share, and most significantly what we share with the plants, vegetables, flowers, everything around us, is water. And it's a precious resource. Starting now, we've really got to concentrate on what's going to happen and focus what's going to happen to our water source here in Sullivan County, which reaches the Delaware, where it's all starting up by the East Branch, and from Binghamton on down to Philadelphia. I mean, that's our Delaware River. That's so important. And there are so many streams and tributaries that lead into that, where historically the farms have used those streams and tributaries and the flooding fields as growing fields. If there's stuff in the water that's getting into the fields, that's a problem. If there's no water, that's also a problem. There's only so much out there. But what surprised me, living now by the river, is how the river changes, how alive the river is. And it's never a static entity. It's so alive, and you really have to engage it almost every day when you live near it. And I think that the people who are coming in just to use it as an industrial resource don't understand that vitality of the river and how it is such a changeable, its own creature, its own character here among us. I mean, these are river towns. These are towns that grew up on the rivers for reasons.
You know, our values have to change. Are we only alive for a short period of time so we can accumulate wealth? It just sounds so sick to do that, to be that way. Don't have an answer for anything, but I definitely think that people should reassess their whole life, find out what's important. My name is Suzanne Bevier. It's a really good chocolate
brownie.
Good, I made them today. They're fresh.
What happens if we end up hating each other because protections are not put in place? What happens if we want to run but we have nowhere to go? What happens if instead of songs of beauty and the natural landscape, we hear the cries in the night of cracking and poisoned water tables? Without water, we will be pulling the trigger, guaranteeing our demise. So as I lift this pure sweet glass of Catskill water to my lips, I ask for the courage to find a better way to move through this life, and I demand that this land is protected so that we all can continue to have a home.
The Beaverkill is running behind me. I'm looking out over the mountains of the Catskills. I am in the Beaverkill at the Adams Barn. This is a Catskill Mountain Keeper event, and people are coming. The rain clouds are overhead, but the rain has not started yet. It's the late afternoon. A breeze is in the air, and it's such a pleasure to be speaking with you. I have Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
in the trailer with me, and I want to focus on water, water issues, and I know you've spent a career very involved advocating for clean water and the issues around it. And we're here in the Catskills, which we have a connection to and is a beautiful place. We're in the Beaverkill. The Beaverkill River is right behind us. If you could share with us thoughts about what we're facing here in the Catskills with water, water issues.
Well, this is kind of an iconic location in the history of the environmental movement. This is the home of American fly fishing, the birthplace, the Bethlehem, with Theodore Gordon and Seth Green and many of the other great progenitors of American recreational fishing started here in the Catskill Mountains, and specifically on the Willowemeck and the Beaverkill River where we are right now. The Catskills is also important, of course, for providing fresh water to most of New York City. 80% of the drinking water for New York State's 10.5 million downstate residents comes from the reservoirs that are fed by the streams and rivers of the Catskill Mountains. And so you have basically the largest, most important city in the United States that's absolutely dependent on the stewardship of this resource. The Catskills it's an extraordinary area. It's a very important part of American City. The first capital of the United States, which was Kingston, New York, is here in the Catskills. Many of the soldiers of the Revolution came from the Catskill Mountains. The Catskills inspired the great movement towards, after the American Revolution, when our country was really seeking to define ourselves and try to figure out who we are. Okay, we're not British. We can't claim the hundreds of years of cultural history of the British. What do we have that that can distinguish us? And we look towards the Greeks and Greek architecture, because they were the creators of democracy, and we were the modern democracy. And we also looked at the wilderness. That was the beginning of this extraordinary wilderness tradition. Our great cultural leaders and our political leaders said to the American people and our philosophers and theological leaders, you don't have to be ashamed because you don't have the 1,500 years of culture that they have in Europe, because you have this relationship to the land, and particularly wilderness, which is the undiluted work of the Creator. And that's going to be the source of your values and your virtues and your character as a people. And you had the school, you had American landscapers like and architects like Andrew Jackson Downing and Frederick Law Olmsted flocked to the area to get a taste of the upper Hudson River Valley and the Catskill Mountains. You had our great painters, the Hudson River School, Thomas Cole, Frederick Church, Samuel F.B. Morris, Bierstadt, and Cropsey, come into the Catskills and paint paintings that would remind Americans of their heritage, what Thomas Jefferson would later call and Teddy Roosevelt would call our national heirlooms. We don't have Westminster Cathedral
to leave.
We don't have the Louvre, but our Louvre is the Catskill Mountains. Westminster Cathedral is the Adirondacks.
Absolutely. It's beautiful to hear you express it in this way. When did your connection to it begin? How would you describe your own?
You know, my father brought us up the Hudson River back in 1966 to do a whitewater trip.
From the kitchen table, out on the road, I'm Sabrina Artel. Trailer Talk gratefully acknowledges the Park Foundation, the New York State Council on the Arts, and the Puffin Foundation for their generous support of our work. Special thanks to the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance in Narrowsburg, New York. We couldn't do this without you and its contributions from people like you that make this project possible. Please go to the Frack Talk section at www.trailertalk.net and talk to us. The Little Beeline and I thank you all for gathering round the Trailer Talk kitchen table for a salon of conversations that have engaged, taught, and inspired us this entire year. Here's to continued people power during this holiday season and for the new year 2010. Thanks for joining me for Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk. The music for the show, Patti Smith, People Have the Power. Trailer Talk is produced by Sabrina Artel. For more information, please visit trailertalk.net. Special thanks to WJFF Radio Catskill and the numerous people who have donated their time, resources, and conversations to make Trailer Talk possible. Thank you all who joined me in these conversations. I'm Sabrina Artel. Safe travels.